Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. 50 years ago this month, the United States Congress passed something called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. I am privileged to welcome to Talk Nation Radio someone with a particular connection to the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. Fred Petucha did 4 tours in Vietnam. Fred Petucha, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
And where are you living now, and what is your life about these days, 50 years later?
Well, I just retired at the end of 2013 as a financial advisor here in Santa Rosa, California, which is in the wine country 50 miles north of San Francisco. I'm blessed with a wonderful wife with 4 children and 5 grandchildren, and thoroughly enjoying retirement.
And how is it that you came to have some involvement with the Gulf of Tonkin incident or lack thereof?
Well, I'll back off just a little bit. Like so many of my generation, my father served in World War II, was a colonel in the Marine Corps, and once a Marine, always a Marine. Our family dog's name was Gung Ho. So to say I grew up in a military environment is certainly true. And I went to Tufts University on a Navy scholarship and was commissioned aboard Old Ironsides in Boston Naval Shipyard. I felt very proud of being an officer and gentleman in the Navy. And then they shipped me out to Vietnam shortly after graduation, where I reported for duty as an ensign and a communications officer on a guided missile destroyer, DDG-16, the Joseph Strauss. The Strauss was the flagship of the Asiatic Squadron and headquartered in Yokosuka. And of those 8 destroyers and 2 of the destroyers in that squadron were the Maddox and the Turner Joy, the ships actually involved in the Tonkin Gulf incident. On a relatively small combatant like a destroyer, most every officer has 1 or more collateral duties. So in addition to being the communications officer, I was also the secret and the top secret control officer. And when I was sent back to some additional schooling for air and intercept control and other things in San Diego. So though I reported to my ship in August of 65, I didn't really assume all those duties until late January, February of 1966.
You say 65, the Gulf of Tonkin incident was in 64, right?
That's correct, August of 64. So I'll make this clear for all your listeners, I was not there at the time of the Tonkin Gulf incident. My knowledge derived from my position as secret and top secret control officer and my investigative bent to read all the files in the secret and top secret message files, plus additional information I came privy to later on my 4th tour. And also to clarify things for people say, oh, if you're 4 tours, you must have been a warmonger. I was a regular naval officer as opposed to a reserve officer. So I had the same commissions if I went to Annapolis or West Point. And at that point, if you were a regular officer, they could send you back as many times as they wanted to. Whereas if you were a reserve or a draftee, you were limited to just 1 tour. So that began my first tour on shipboard. In the Navy, the communications, the secret and top secret files normally stay with the ship. But if the Navy establishes a station, which is just basically coordinates in the ocean, the file stays with the station, not with the ship. So in this period of time, a ship would be on station in the Tonkin Gulf, generally 30 days, and it'd be relieved by another destroyer. And so I was privy to these secret and top messages, secret files, that went back to the beginning of the ship on station, which was in the late 1963. All I had to do was page check these files. They were just numbered, 1 through 100, or I don't remember how many pages were there, just to make sure all the pages were in the file. But being the kind of investigative guy I took a lot of history courses at Tufts University, I started reading all these files, and periodically they would make reference to an operations order, especially MAROPS, or Maritime Operations, and they kept referring to SOG 34, which is Special Operations Group 34. So you got a picture. I'm in kind of like a large closet. That was the vault. And on the above my desk were these secret and top secret operation orders. So again, I would reference, they'd say reference so-and-so page and not stop board. So I would not only read the message traffic, but I would read the operation orders. Basically, what I discovered is that there was the first Tonkin Gulf attack or incident. In fact, it occurred. There were rockets and torpedoes that came in the general vicinity of the Maddox, but the PT boats from the North Vietnam that were going firing these were not going after the Maddox. They were going after a CIA-run PT boats.
PT boats of the South that were intending to provoke.
They were being controlled. They were being, the South Vietnamese PT boats were really in operations controlled by the CIA.
And is
with,
it
with Navy SEALs on board as advisors?
Is it accurate to say that this was an operation intended to provoke a response from the North so that the U.S. ships off the shore could identify locations?
Yes.
Okay.
And then I discovered further that the second attack never even occurred. So let me kind of flesh this out a little bit. Back when Kennedy was still alive and in office, it authorized this SOG 34, our Special Operations Group, and that consisted of two primarily operations. One, these were all specially trained South Vietnamese commandos. Some would be dropped under cover of night into the jungles of North Vietnam with time satchel charges with the idea of trying to blow up bridges, rail lines, transshipment points, and so on. So that was a significant part of SOG 34. The other part were these MAROPS, and they had specially called Nasty Class PT boats, which, interestingly enough, were manufactured by Sweden. They were actually faster and higher performance than the PT boats the Navy had. And they would go up along the coastline of North Vietnam starting in October of 63, and only in the dark of the moon. So generally, they only operated 4 or 5 days of the month, and it was overcast, not even starlight. And they would be 3 or 4 miles offshore, and then at selected insertion points, they would go into perhaps a quarter mile offshore, drop their frogmen, swimmer sappers, off, and they would swim into shore and try to place time satchel charges against the hull, coastal junks, fuel farms, and other targets. The MAROPS were blowing the hell out of the coastline in North Vietnam for approximately 10 months before the supposed unprovoked attack on the Maddox. Smoking gun, and by the way, this time, this was the Maddox, it was what called DeSoto patrols. And the DeSoto, there was a Navy security group aboard the Maddox with special, very top-secret, sensitive monitoring information to intercept Vietnamese communications and to also ascertain where there were surface search or fire control radar and installations along the coastline of North Vietnam. On the 2nd, there was a message that I read with my own eyes from CNO, Chief of Naval Operations, to CO Maddox, not info anybody, not info Stinkpack Fleet, info the CTF-77, the admiral on the carrier group. And so that's very unusual in the Navy to have something not go via the chain of command, or at least info the chain of command. And it basically said that there would be these MAROPS craft operating in that area and that they should stand by to aid assistance if necessary. Then I also saw a message that was sent to the MAROPS craft with info copy to the Maddox, just stating, telling the MAROPS craft that if should they be interdicted by North Vietnamese PT boats, that they should flee out to sea to these specific coordinates to seek the safe haven provided by U.S. destroyer. So when these PT boats came along caught near Han My Island, which is about 3 miles off coast of North Vietnam, these PT boats that came out, and again, they were trying to interdict these South Vietnamese, well, really operated by the CIA, but they were primarily South Vietnamese swimmer sappers or commandos on board, along with U.S. Navy frogmen or SEAL, Navy SEALs as advisors. So that's how the first incident occurred. So again, to repeat for your listeners, a real incident did occur, but it is my firm belief that the torpedoes and rockets that came in the general vicinity of the Maddox were primarily or exclusively going after the PT boats. which had been wreaking havoc along the coastline for the previous 10 months.
But the supposed, by the way, we are speaking with Fred Petuccia, veteran of the U.S. Navy and of the squadron in which the USS Maddox was a part. The story, as I understand it, is that the second incident that you say you read in the secret files did not occur at all. There was a cable to Washington immediately after the initial report saying, wait a minute, we're not sure anything happened at all, and that Secretary of so-called Defense McNamara failed to pass that second communication along to the President or the Congress, communicating to them, knowing it was probably false, only the first communication that there had been an attack. Is that what happened?
Essentially, yes. There were several dozen flash messages sent by the Maddox. And by the way, after the initial incident, the Navy dispatched a second destroyer, the Turner Joy, to join the Maddox. So there were two destroyers involved in the supposed second incident. And it was at night. Clearly from the message traffic, both the Maddox and Turner Joy thought they saw MiGs, or at least unidentified aircraft, we call them bogeys, that threatened, could be threatening ships, and also thought they detected screw beats, which could have been PT boats coming out after them. They fired a number of star shells in the area to try to illuminate. They called a Navy fighter jets off the carrier, and they flew right through where they were directed, where these bogeys were, on the radar scope. They never saw any aircraft. They never saw any PT boats. Now, on that, my first tour, I was an air intercept controller, so I can verify personally that the Tonkin Gulf was really unique, perhaps not in the whole world, but certainly unique in that part of the world, in having a high incidence of false radar contacts and a high incidence of false sonar contacts. Many more experienced sonarmen and radarmen than myself would tell me that, gee, Mr. Petuccia, you got to watch out, because these bogeys you're seeing, they are just a phantom. So I don't try to dissuade the sailors and officers and men of the Maddox and Turner Joy to believing for a short period of time that they were in danger of being under attack. But the key point is, after I read several dozen messages, last messages, which they really, at the time they sent them, I do believe the Maddox and Turner Joy thought they were, if not actually under attack, in danger of being attacked. But, again, they flew these fighter jets right over the area. They had illuminated with star shells. And so approximately 1 hour after everything subsided, the CEO of the Maddox sent an after-action report and essentially said, highly unusual sonar and radar conditions, and believe no attack actually occurred. So until very recently, I mean within the last few weeks, I thought all these years that when Johnson spoke before Congress and the American people and said, our attacks, our ships were assailing us in the high seas, our seas, and were attacked not once but twice, that he knew that the second attack had never occurred. Just recently, coming out, people going through archival information, that although the Navy, the senior officer of the Navy, had seen the after-action report and knew that a second attack did not occur, that this information was never passed on by McNamara to President Johnson. So, as I say, one of the things I think of when I think back to that time was, hey, LBJ, how many kids you killed today? And I think so much of the blame for the tragedy of the Vietnam War lay purely on President Johnson. But it turns out, looks like, that a significant part of that blame deserves to be with Secretary of Defense McNamara. That being said, while I have certainly no evidence that I saw with my own eyes, I find it difficult to believe that President Johnson did not know about the DeSoto patrols, did not know about SOG 34, and that these swimmer sappers had been wreaking havoc along the coastline of North Vietnam for a full 10 months before these incidents. So the other part of Johnson's statement, that our ships were sailing innocently in the high seas, an attack without provocation by the evil communists in North Vietnam, I have to believe that as commander-in-chief, he must have known about SOG 34 and the Soto patrols.
Well, my understanding is that reporters in Vietnam knew that this was going on, and that when the Congress voted on the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, that the House voted 418-0, and the Senate voted 98-2. And one of those two senators was Wayne Morse from Oregon, who denounced the entire pretext in explicit terms and pointed out that if you are patrolling the shores of a foreign country and attacking it and provoking it to claim that you've been innocently attacked and that they are the aggressor, it gets it backwards, and that Congress ought to be defeating this resolution or authorizing war, but not passing sort of a fuzzy measure that's going to be used as if it were a declaration of war. So it seems that if Johnson had had Morse's skepticism, he might have taken a different course, that he wasn't completely helpless in the matter.
Yes, I would certainly agree. Now, I think there was sadly, a mental mindset among the leaders in Washington, including, quote, the best and the brightest, the term used for Kennedy's cabinet, that all you had to do was call someone a communist, and they were definitely bad, and that the communist threat was a monolithic threat coming out of Moscow and Peking. And in fact, while Ho Chi Minh was nominally a communist, he was first and foremost a national socialist. And people forget that he was our ally in World War II, that with the help of arms drop, we were supplying the Viet Minh small arms to provide interdiction efforts, guerrilla warfare against the Japanese in Indochina. And this was done by Colonel Chennault. And in return for Ho Chi Minh's support, we promised him that we would support his demands, desire for independence from French colonial rule after the war was over. But then all they had to do is say, oh, he's a communist. Well, we can't have that. So, we reneged on that promise. But I firmly believe that if we had honored that promise, we would have, granted, he was going to be a dictator, but we would have had a strong, united Vietnam that would have been a bulwark against Chinese and Soviet expansion and interest in South Vietnam, in Southeast Asia, the same way that Tito, as a quote, National Socialist in Yugoslavia, provided a bulwark against further Soviet expansion into Eastern and Southern Southeastern Europe.
And the people of Vietnam would have been left to run their country as legally required, and 4 million lives would have been spared. So it doesn't seem a difficult call. So what did you do when this is after the fact? You're now in this same squadron, and you're reading these legal documents, and you're discovering this evidence that the incident did not happen. Then what did you do next?
Well, I was absolutely shocked, because I guess naively believed that our president wouldn't lie to us, especially in matters of war and peace. And so in the Navy, there's a procedure if you want to bring something out of matter of official record called Captain's Mask, which primarily in Navy tradition is used just against enlisted men, where it's a phrase from the sailing days where you stood before the mast and you received, quote, military justice levied on you by the commanding officer. So, but there is a procedure, because I was also had the desire, I was the naval just justice office on the ship. That was another one of my collateral duties. So I knew about this, and I requested captain's mast. And I wanted to get the facts that I just related to you out in the ship's record, which became with much more matter of people have ready access to it. And so this is highly unusual for an officer, especially a lowly junior ensign, to request captain's mast. So I was called into the stateroom of our executive officer, Lieutenant Commander Hardesty, and saying essentially, what's going on here? Why are you requesting captain's mast? And I relayed to him pretty much what I've just shared with you and your listeners. And he was shocked that I would consider, you know, trying to do this. He said, don't you realize you could be court-martialed for revealing military secrets? I see in your records that your father was a much-decorated Marine hero in World War II. Think of the shame and dishonor this would bring to your family, on and on. And I was still trying to stand my ground, my moral high ground, but frankly feeling increasingly intimidated and afraid. And then he said, and besides, you're just seeing a little piece of the picture. All these Fulbright and all the other people in Congress, they knew about all this when they voted for the Tonkin Gulf resolution. So you just didn't, if you saw the big picture they saw, you wouldn't feel the way you do. And you see, that was the kind of lie that I could sort of accept and leave myself some sense of honor and integrity. So, sadly, I lied to myself. I said, oh, that's it, because that's a excuse that I could live with and leave my sense of honor intact. And so I shut up. I withdrew my request for captain's mast and did not speak about what I'd learned, you know, for many years until I was actually out of the Navy.
And we don't have a whole lot of time left. I know you also learned about the Phoenix program, but I also know that you went back to Vietnam just this past spring. I wonder if you could talk about what that was like.
Yes, it was a group out of Northern California called Veterans Vietnam Restoration Project, and about every 9 months, they send a team of veterans to do humanitarian projects, mostly building schools or medical clinics. So I went back in 2002 to help build 10 homes for disabled Vietnamese veterans, and then I went back in April of this year, and I'll just leave your listeners with two little vignettes. The first time in 2002, we were actually meeting these former Viet Cong, and they had all major injuries. They'd lost an arm or a leg. One guy was almost blind from fighting in the war. And with the help of my interpreter, I found out every one of them had lost one or more family members, their brothers, sisters, parents, to fighting in the war. And I kept looking for signs of bitterness, anger, hatred. Never could see it. They treated us as honored guests. And whenever I'm in a highly charged emotional situation, I try to always put myself in the other person's shoes. And I thought to myself, wow, if Vietnam had come over, bombed the hell out of California, destroyed my town, destroyed my home, killed some of my immediate family, and left me with a lifelong disability, and then showed up 30 years later, and kind of, I'm going to build you a new house, I'd say, well, you. You know, I mean, that gift of forgiveness that myself and my fellow veterans received was invaluable, and it started to enable me to forgive myself for participating in a war I didn't believe in. And then this last time, the most significant thing is we building the school, but the Vietnamese we were working alongside were in their 30s and 40s. They didn't really remember the war. But at the final celebration, when we finished, I looked over, and there were a group of about 10 older Vietnamese with their dress uniforms with all the ribbons on. And I said, well, who are these? Oh, those are the heroes of this village. And so I liked to talk to them. So this one fellow, he was born in June of 43, the same year as me, and we really connected at some level. And we talked for maybe 15, 20 minutes. And part of it, I said to him, you know, I have such respect for the courage and tenacity of the Viet Cong. They stayed and fought bravely in the fight of overwhelming firepower, the B-52 bombers, the helicopter gunships, the napalm. And I was just in awe of that. And he said, well, we were fighting for our country. And then he said, you know, we were really impressed by the bravery of the American soldier, that you were in our terrain. We knew the jungles. We knew where the tunnels were. And you would fight bravely. And he said, what were you fighting for? Of course, I had no answer.
Yeah, it's always hard to have an answer to that one. Do you think that the culture in which revenge seems so automatic, that if someone had done this to us, we would never forgive them, is part of the same culture that leads the United States into so many wars in the first place?
Definitely. I mean, I'm not sure if it's the Buddhism or just some part of the Oriental philosophy, but I'm not the only one. I mean, everyone that I know that's gone back to Vietnam has been amazed that we are really treated with grace, with open arms. And we certainly could learn a lot from them. And, you know, but this revenge and the stupid part, I mean, the lies that LBJ and McNamara and so on told my generation, I think were almost mild compared to the lies that Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld told the current generation about Iraq. I mean, there were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no yellow cape uranium from Niger. There were no aluminum tubes or centrifuges. And yet, not only have Cheney and Bush kind of gotten off scot-free, I mean, there was never even close to a movement for impeachment. And, I mean, there's no question that Bush, Cheney, and himself lied to the American people about those things I just mentioned. The only question is, I mean, all lies is an untrue statement. So they clearly made untrue statements. The only question is, at the time they made the statement, did they know they were untrue? Because if for some reason...
Well, that's not an open question. I'm sorry to disagree with you.
I don't know if we have proof to find definitive proof. At the very least, Congress should have initiated a special, you know, committee, just like they did for Nixon and the Watergate. You know, what did the president know, and when did he know it?
Undoubtedly. And maybe educating people about the Gulf of Tonkin incident and all of these other lies and disastrous wars of the past will help. I wish we could go on. We've been speaking with Fred Petuccia about a sort of iconic war lie of a half century ago this month. Fred, thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David. I look forward to hearing this on the air, and thank you for your good work and try to educate and inform the American people.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.